has held that position since 1970. He's had a distinguished career in the music field. He's been jazz critic for the Saturday Review, the Evergreen Review, New York Times, and Downbeat, among others. And he's written a number of books on jazz, film, and also the American comic strip. Perhaps he can explain how that one worked in. He's written articles on children's literature, film, radio, and TV, and he is the recipient of the Deems Taylor Award in Music Criticism. His most recent, and perhaps to some of us, most interesting project has been in producing a number of reconstructed original cast albums for the Smithsonian reissue program. Martin Williams.
Thank you. When this project first started and these recordings first began to appear, I was interviewed by a reporter from a local Washington paper. I won't tell you which one, but no one offered them a Pulitzer Prize. And in the middle of this, when I am earnestly and very interestedly talking about what this thing is about, how we do it, as I hope to talk to you about, the reporter stopped me and said, "Why are you doing this?" in an accusatory tone like that, and I heard myself saying, "Because it's there." So it was either climb Mount Everest or do these records. Well, what is there is this. The possibility of reconstructing from a complex of archival sources original cast recordings of American musical comedy, chiefly, although you can do vaudeville and other aspects of musical theater as well, putting together an album, which in effect is an original cast album, of shows that were played before there was any such thing. Let me give you, by way of example, I always use the show from 1928, that starred Eddie Cantor and was written around his talent called Whoopee, this show, from which comes Love Me or Leave Me and Making Whoopee, both of which I'm sure you all know. How could you avoid knowing it? Eddie Cantor, at the time this show played, was a star recording artist for Victor Records. And one of the two leading ladies in the show was Ruth Etting, who was also a star at Columbia Records. In fact, she was in the show just by virtue of the fact that she made successful records. She had never done very much of this kind of work before, only nightclub work. Each of them recorded songs from the show, and I'm hedging that statement a little bit for reasons we'll get to in a minute, for their respective labels. Also, at this period, it was fashionable to put a dance band, a dance orchestra, into a show up on stage as part of the show. I don't mean in the pit, I mean up there. The most famous example of this is George Gershwin's Girl Crazy from a couple of seasons after the show. But it was done in this show with George Olson's orchestra, and some of his featured singers were given parts, small parts, in the show. And in fact, his wife, girl singer, Ethel Schuette, was one of the stars of the show. And that presents an interesting problem, too, we'll get to in a minute. In any case, he recorded for Victor, and his material, or actually other material as well, from the show, was recorded by George Olson's band for Victor Records. And there are some other aspects of this that that can be included in such a reconstruction, because there was a falling out between Florence Ziegfeld, who was producer of the show, and George Olson soon after the show was into its run, and Olson was replaced by Paul Whiteman. And some of his singers were replaced by a group of male singers called the Ritz Quartet. They also recorded material from the show. So there you have other reasonably authentic original cast recordings. So from Whoopee, we have reconstructed two sides of an LP record. There's almost too much material from this show to put on an LP, literally. There is quite a wealth of it from this show. This is all domestic sources for this particular show, however. Now, there are other shows chiefly Gershwin shows and at least one Porter show and some Kearns, for instance, which are there by virtue of the fact that it was quite fashionable in England and in London to record this kind of material while a show was on, much more so than in this country. So, for instance, Gershwin's Lady Be Good, most of the material comes from the London run when Fred and Adele Astaire were a part of a recording project, as they always were when they went to England with their shows, almost always, for Columbia Records in England. Now, some of that material from British sources, of course, is quite easy to come by virtue of World Record Club and by virtue of Monmouth Evergreen over here. Our albums include a little more material, and I'll get to that point in a minute. But the existence of the Lady Be Good album, or ours, brings up another question, which is that composer performances are also considered fair game in this particular game. Now, let me warn you all, you cannot get a fair and adequate picture of what musical comedy was like in this country from this kind of a source, both because major composers, major artists, major Broadway performers never made records. There are no possible Rodgers and Hart shows, for instance, that one can do except for the revival of a Connecticut Yankee, which was done much after the fact and under the auspices of Rodgers and Hammerstein. There are two Cole Porter shows which one can do with a good representation, but that's it. There are bits and pieces from other shows, but that's another. Then on the other hand, there are shows which were very unimportant and not very good, which are there in quantity. For instance, a show called Bottomland, which was written musically, supposedly, I'm not so sure about that, and in its script by Clarence Williams, and by virtue of all his connections and all his activity in recording studios, Clarence Williams recorded just about everything in Bottomland, except the sketches and the dialogue, for several record companies, OK in Columbia particularly, but Paramount as well. So here we have everything from the show that, well, the best song in it is pretty evidently stolen from After You've Gone. But we're going to do it because it's there. And it makes a wonderful, it's about a half an album, and it makes a wonderful thing to put on the other side of a much more important show called Runnin' Wild, for which is about material for half a record. So there are, however, to go back to Whoopi, some flaws and some exceptions to this. For instance, the first song in the show of any note, and the first song by the female lead, Whoopi was written by Gus Kahn and Walter Donaldson, I should say, is a song called I'm Bringing a Red, Red Rose. Now, Ruth Etting recorded that for Columbia. Ruth Etting was in the show, but she did not sing that song in the show. Ethel Schuette sang it in the show. And here we have George Olson recording his band and his four male singers and not his wife, who played the lead in the show. Interesting footnote to this, biographical footnote. When Olson walked out of the show, taking his four singers with him, she stayed in the show. Nevertheless, they stayed married and happy for years thereafter, I'm told. I didn't look that up, but I'll take people's word for that. Also, as many songs as Cantor recorded for this show, and he recorded more than were in it, and I'll get to that point in a minute, he did not record a nice little song, which very few people know, but it's a nice little song called Until You Get Somebody Else. That was recorded by Olson with one of his singers doing the vocal. So we include that version, although that's not the singer who did it in the show. All those people were associated with the show. So you get this kind of slight fudging going on. And I said Cantor did more than was in the show, because in those days it was quite common for the lead to have a kind of open spot, usually in the second act, in which he could interpolate, or she in some cases, anything they wanted to. So Eddie Cantor pops out of a stove, supposedly, in blackface, of course, and does his latest records for about 20 minutes or however long he and the audience could stand it. And because a couple of reviewers from Variety were there and wrote down what these interpolations were, we put them in the album as far as we could find them. So we have in this this particular set, we have a song called Hungry Women, which is pretty well stolen from one of Cantor's other songs. Actually, it's almost identical. We have a song called Eddie Cantor's Automobile Horn Song, and we have something called I Fall Down, Go Boom. And then, to make this even more complicated, one of the songs that Cantor interpolated into this, he didn't record, but Ruth Etting did, so what the hell, we just put that in too. And that's a song called, why not? It was in the show, right? She was in the show. Now, again, we're not trying to rewrite history or kid anybody or deceive anybody about it. All this stuff is spelled out specifically in the notes, although when I was working on this presentation, I realized that I hadn't admitted, or I guess that's the right word, that although My Blackbird's a Bluebird Now by Ruth Etting was a song interpolated into the show, I didn't say that she had not actually interpolated it. But as I say, there are no games being played here, deliberately anyway. Now, let's get to the more interesting. Let me give you some other examples of shows before I do that. Lady Be Good, I've spoken about. Here is a half an album to Cole Porter's Let's Face It. And the other half, some kind of miscellaneous Cole Porter material from two other shows, Red Hot and Blue and Leave It to Me. Let's Face It featured Danny Kaye, who recorded his numbers for Columbia. It featured a woman who had two lead parts on Broadway and then absolutely disappeared from the American Musical Theater. Her name is Mary Jane Walsh. And she recorded numbers for the Liberty Music Shops label, and that's the source of that, as some of you know. And here we have used some material by a performer not in the show. There are two songs by the singer who called herself Hildegard, who is about as French as Ole Olsen, as you all know. But she used to sing a kind of gibberish French in nightclubs around New York. And she did two songs from this show. She sings in a very microphone style. She's not projecting in a theatrical manner. But the accompaniment and the general tone of these is pretty close to the style of the show, particularly the accompaniment. So we have used those two to piece out the album. And again, I always, you're always of two minds about including things like this, but sometimes you do. For instance, here's Hot Chocolates, which we heard about earlier today. Here we have items by Fats Waller, the composer, who also performed in the show in some of its versions, by the way. We have items by Louis Armstrong, of course, one of which you heard a part of this morning. We have Edith Wilson doing her material. We have liner notes by Dan Morgenstern, who's sitting over there. And we have two numbers here, which were dance numbers in the show, which were composed by Waller, Snake Hips Dance and Jungle Jamboree. Now these are by a group of musicians from the Ellington Orchestra. But again, I said, in the notes, I said, this seems a reasonably compatible style of playing this music, so we put them in here. There were a couple of other songs from the show that did get recorded, and I listened to them, and I said, that's just not close enough to the way they would have done it in the show, so let's just not use it. There are also comedy sketches from the show on the record, and right now I want to tell you all something very important about sources of this, where we get our recordings, since that comes up often. We get most of our recordings from that gentleman sitting there in the striped jacket, Jack Raymond. If it were not for private collectors and their resources, it would be impossible to do this job, and particularly for that man there, because he happens to live very close by, which makes it convenient. And there are a handful of avid collectors of this material. Jack Raymond is one. Dan Langan in New York, who's a publicist working in the theater, is another. And we rely on those people. It's very difficult, I'm sorry to have to say, to go to Lincoln Center and borrow a record. You have to have the credentials, more credentials that say whether they would get you through the U.S. Customs. that's okay. but as you know, this kind of activity, I think, in any culture is apt to start with private collectors, and then our libraries get it, and then our academicians get it. But it starts with guys like you all and guys like Jack, and without that, we couldn't function. Also, I would like to mention that our transfers are done by a man named Jack Towers, who is a private collector in the Washington area, an avid Ellington freak, and he does the best tape transfers of anyone I have ever worked with. He also has a method of de-clicking, which does not involve cutting the tape, but scraping the emulsion off the back of the tape so you don't lose any musical time, you don't have any jerky effect. And you know, some people don't hear that, some people, all of us should hear it. It's very evident, particularly at slow tempos when there's been de-clicking, and you can even hear the sound of the thing going by if you listen carefully. And so Jack's method works best. Now, I know there's a demagnetizing process that's also, but I think this scraping works better. It's very laborious and painstaking, and thank God for Jack Towers. Okay, let's go back now, and let me give you some little examples of the kind of thing we've done. I said whoopee was a complex question. There was a recording which Jack Raymond had, a 12-inch Brunswick record, which is labeled Whoopee Medley and credited to the Colonial Club Orchestra. Now, according to the discographies, the Colonial Club Orchestra is actually a band called the Ambassadors, which, as some of us know, began in the early days as a rather interesting white jazz ensemble, ended up as kind of a hotel band. I question that identification because this doesn't sound like that kind of thing to me. And here's why. This whoopee medley, so-called, is not a medley. It's not a dance medley, heaven knows. It is an overture. It is in overture style, so much so that it even borrows a little effect from the Barber of Seville, as you'll hear in a minute. It's quite surprising. I cannot conceive that anyone would have gone out and got someone to make an arrangement just for an anonymous record date in this style. It makes no sense at all. I am myself convinced that they borrowed this from the pit, if they did not borrow the orchestra from the pit, and recorded it as an inexpensive way of getting out a record for, you know, some songs from a hit show. That's what I think happened. However, there's one problem with that theory, and you will be acquainted with it when we play an excerpt from this. Okay, the first cut on the tape, if you want. Thank you.
time for just reminiscing, regretting instead of forgetting with somebody else. There'll be no one unless that someone is you. But I don't want to borrow, to have it today and to give back tomorrow. For my love is your love, there's no love for nobody else.
Sorry about the other side of that tape. I thought it was recorded all across and we wouldn't have it. Can you cut out a channel or something? It's all on one channel? Maybe it's quarter track and you can... Jack, do you know? Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll just have to bear with it, I guess. I'm sorry. Well, obviously the problem there is that singer who comes in. Let's assume she was a trombone solo in the original or for half a chorus and something. And it is... She is not identified on the record, but if anybody wants to bet with me, it's Vaughn DeLeaf. It's obviously she, very popular in the early days of radio, and she made a lot of records. Well, now we couldn't have that there, of course, so we just do a little editing. Next one. It's got to be. Okay, now, it's too bad that our overture, in effect, our overture, does not include a ballad tempo on the show's most celebrated ballad, but that's that. I didn't feel we had any choice but to cut it out. But again, you say in the notes whenever you do anything like this, naturally. Here's another one. Cantor, of course, recorded Making Whoopee. He probably recorded it many times. We use the one closest to the source. This is the Victor version from, I think, the same year. Now, Olsen recorded it, but in Olsen's records, of course, we are dealing with a dance band style. So we have instrumental chorus, probably instrumental verse, vocal chorus, sometimes with a modulation, instrumental chorus or part chorus to take it out, depending on how much time you've got. And that's the pattern of all of Olsen's records. Well, it would be wrong to, of course, include both these vocal versions, but you want all the material you've got. So let's assume, because this is a reasonable assumption, Cantor sang it, and then somebody danced it. Maybe all the people they had who could dance. So you put it together like this for purposes of recording. Again, admitting what you're doing.
Who thinks he's funny, says you pay six to her.
He says, now judge, suppose I fail. The judge says, budge, right into jail. You'd better keep her, you'll find it's cheaper than making whoopee.
Thank you.
In the case of this song, Come West, Little Girl, this was sung by people billed in the playbill as the Four Cowboys. One step in this, of course, is to go to the playbill and get the order of the songs as they were done in the show, which is not always simple because sometimes that changed in the course of a run in those days, by the way. Things were not as rigid then as they seem to be today. They're not that rigid today, actually. Anyway, this little song called Come West, Little Girl was sung by the Four Cowboys, and the Four Cowboys are actually George Olsen's singers, that is, those guys in the band who could carry a tune with their voices in addition to their instruments, pretty much that. Now, he did this again in dance band style. There's instrumental, and then there's a vocal in the middle. Well, they're not going to do it that way in the show. So what I decided to do here was to take the vocal out of the middle, put it up front, and then have it as a kind of reprise again, same vocal. Something interesting happens here. Listen carefully. You'll see someone, or you'll hear someone, kick a mic stand toward the end of this thing. There's a big thump. When this record came out, all the reviewers said, well, we've already had all that on Monmouth Evergreen. Why did they do this? Well, there are exactly 5 78 sides in this album that are not on Monmouth, and I don't mean to put down that label, nor its proprietor, who's been most helpful to us. But one of the things we have here, as some of you know, Victor Arden and Phil Oman, a duo piano team, worked with the Gershwins, would play in the pit, would play intermission piano as an entr'acte, and incidentally, in those days, the sheet music from the show was also sold there in the theater at intermission. And so with 2 recordings of material from Funny Face by Arden and Oman, as we usually call them, we obviously had to use this. So we've concocted a kind of prologue from one of their recordings, and we have concocted an entr'acte from the other, both medleys from material in the show. There was only one problem there, and that is that the one of the medleys, the one that we used for the prologue, actually had a vocal in it by a man named Johnny Marvin, who had nothing to do with the show, nor did anyone working in that style have anything to do with it. There is a vocal in the other medley, the one we used for the intermission piece, also, but it is by a male quartet, and actually, when this show ran, the intermission piece did feature a male quartet. As it happens, apparently not this one, although you can't be sure because you know how pseudonyms work on labels, but I think not. I think that's pretty sure. But they were obviously doing the thing in the same style. And it was the same Ritz Quartet, by the way, in the show that worked in Whoopee. They're contracted to Brunswick. Arden and Oman are recording for Victor, so they use another quartet. Incidentally, one of the singers in that quartet was a fellow named James Melton, who had some interesting career later on. Okay, now, one thing, so I just wanted to show you how we eliminated a vocal in this little prologue I concocted, and it really sounds absolutely seamless to me this time. I don't remember where it happened unless I really remind myself. Thank you. Many of you know that one of the early examples of 33 and a third recording was a version of this show. It was done for RCA. It was not micro groove. The groove size was standard 78, but the turntable was moving at 33 and a third. Also, when that record, and that's been reissued, it's a half of an LP that's been put out several times. Now, but at the same time that those recordings were made with brief versions of songs from the Bandwagon by Fred and Adele Astaire and by the orchestra, which was, Leo Reisman, but I was trying to think, not necessarily a part of the show, but the orchestrations probably were. That's about what that comes down to. There were longer 78s made of a lot of the songs. So obviously we had to use those in this particular album. Also, there is other material here that we've included. Robert Russell Bennett, as some of you know, recorded that song called Hoops from the show later in 1944 for that little label called Sonora. So we have that here. And there is a High and Low that was also used in a London production, which we have included. That's another song from the show. However, now, I should say that Jack Raymond did this album himself. I didn't do this. I just sort of said, go ahead, have fun. But Jack concocted this as an opening, as a kind of prologue to our recording of this show. Sounds like this. What that is, well, I think it makes a nice little beginning to a record, and part of the overture might have sounded exactly like that, who can say, but what that is leftovers from the LP version, instrumental leftovers, that were, you know, we wanted to do something with them, so we did that, and then there you are. There's no duplicate, there's duplication of that material, but not in that particular performance. Okay, now let's get to the really fun part. I said that composer items are considered fair in this, and whenever, by the way, we have a composer performance of a song and then an artist who did it in the show, I always feel we should put the composer first and the performer second, because that's something about the evolution of the show. Also, when we were doing Lady Be Good, we found an interpolation. Ukulele Ike was in that show, and he had the chutzpah to put one of his own songs into the middle of his curtains, and so we've included that. And it's a pretty awful song, but that's history, so that's, you know, I work for a museum, so that's how that is. Now, we did have a broadcast of Gershwin playing The Man I Love. Now, The Man I Love, as some of you know, was originally a part of Lady Be Good. It was used in the Philadelphia tryout and then later cut from that show and subsequently cut from two other Gershwin shows. It never made a show. But of course, it is one of the Gershwin standards. And since we had this Man I Love from broadcast, which could be easily cleared, I decided to put it back in the show in the spot where it originally played and just, again, admit in the notes that this is what we're doing. Now, first of all, I'd like to tell you that, of course, we have to do everything legally, and we can't take chances on fudging. Broadcast material is extremely difficult to clear, and one of the reasons is that nobody really knows how to clear it. And that's how that is. However, George Garabedian, who runs that Mark label in California, had already used This Man I Love on one of his records, so that, in effect, was already cleared by whatever means he used that. I'm told he got the copy out of Ira Gershwin's attic, or Ed Jablonski got it there. And that's how it found its way, and it was okay with Ira, and everything was all right. So we again, used it, with Ira Gershwin's approval and Garabedian's written consent. However, in that old copy of The Man I Love from the attic, there was a flaw. There are two skips in the bridge of the piece. This is how it sounded on Garabedian's issue. Side changed. Okay. Oh, really? Here's our version. Ed Jablonski wanted to know how we did that. Of course, I never told him. Jack did the first one, by the way. He figured out how to get that half a beat out of there that I couldn't think of. And I did the second. Okay, here's another one. For OK, the Gershwin Show, that material is quite common. It's, most of it has been frequently reissued. But in the Columbia 12-inch Gems from OK, some of you know that souvenir records of Gems from so-and-so were made by both labels at one period and for a much longer period made by Victor. But in that Columbia Gems, there is a version of the title song. Now, in the show, it was done by Kay or Gertrude Lawrence and the men. There was a male quartet singing in male chorus style with a two-piano accompaniment on the Gems version, and I decided to see if we could use that on the record, again, identifying it as not necessarily cast material, but just cast performance style. This is how it sounded in the Gems medley on the old Columbia 12-inch.
Okay, you're okay with me. You're here. Okay, you're okay with me. This year, Venus couldn't compare. Venus,
you put charms and two gold arms, and
you're like a beautiful home. This year, you could break up any home. Say,
rolling, keep rolling. This is our version now. It's up in the intro, but it took a while to find it. I didn't find it. Brock Holmes found it. Okay, here's one more of these. This again is a song from Whoopi, and it's got three titles. In my experience, it's called the Gypsy Song in the program. It's also called When the Sunset Meets the Sea, and I knew it as a kid because for some reason I heard it on the radio and remembered it as My Heart is Just a Gypsy. But in the show, apparently it had no vocal, and it was a production number. And what we had was a little short suggestion of it, really, from the Victor Gems, violin cadenzas and a little bit of something in tempo. And on the Victor Gems, this is what it sounded like.
Thank you. That wasn't sung in the show. Keep going. It's 12:30, and I'm finished because that's the end of the tape. I apologize for its quality again. Do you have any questions? Attacks? Yes, Dave.
No attacks. Just a quick question, which is to say, will, for the benefit of some of us, will you give us a brief description of your licensing and clearance procedures?
Thank you, because that raises a very good point, and I meant to mention this. This could not be done. Could not have been done, none of this, unless we got RCA and CBS to sit down and make nice on the same disc. And I believe, and this was recently confirmed for me, that up to this point they had not done that. They had done it since. But the way I was able to do it is, God bless him, go to Tom Shepard at RCA, recently arrived at RCA, he's still there, and did that magnificent album with Sweeney Todd. If you haven't heard it, hear it. And say, Tom, will you help us get this through RCA? And he had previously been at CBS, at Columbia Records, and he did. And with RCA saying they would do it if CBS would, then it became a relatively simple matter to bring that about. We have approached every company and we license in the usual manner, and we pay the fees accordingly. And whoever does our production and pressing for us, we select, it's either going to be Victor or Columbia, and we do it by saying whoever has the majority of the material on the disc gets to do it. And that's very unfair as it works out, because it's more often one company than another, and I won't go into that. But nevertheless, that seemed the only way to handle it. And they, for the Smithsonian, they pay the licensing fees to the record companies, they pay the royalty fees to the composers in the usual manner, in our name. In other words, they do what's now called in the business the fulfillment for us, but we don't turn over the design or the mastering or any of that to them for reasons that have already been discussed from this platform today, and I concur in that. However, we must let them do our pressing, otherwise I'm sure we wouldn't get to use the material the way that we have been allowed to use. Yes, Steve.
Apart from the, there, I've just kicked the mic again. Apart from the dance band arrangements, how close have you found the orchestral backgrounds to the commercial records to the pit arrangement used in the show?
Well, one can only guess at that, because as you know, it is very rare for the music, for the parts, for any of that, for any kind of a score, to survive from those shows. We don't know what they sounded like, and it's usually thrown away. Some of it has come up. Maybe Thor knows more about that than I do. But this is just guesswork. I think that overture was that we've used was the overture. I don't know if Olson played that way on stage. My guess would be, why wouldn't he? He had the chart there. He wasn't going to make another arrangement for recording purposes that could serve as a dance number, but again, we're only guessing. Ruth Etting's backgrounds are usually more than competent white jazz musicians. Eddie Lang and Joe Venuti are on a lot of her records and so forth. And Bunny Berrigan's supposed to be on some of them, and not these. She's not getting the kind of accompaniment she would have got on stage, I don't think. And probably, again, with a singer like that singing up on a stage with accompaniment down here, she's going to have the violin doubling her so she won't lose her place and so forth. And that's not going to be on the record. But then it's not on a record today, and it's done in the theater. So that's one thing I should remind you of. What you hear on original cast record today is not what you're going to hear at the Booth Theater, necessarily. There are changes all the time, including doubling the orchestra, sometimes more than doubling it. So I don't know, it's guesswork, you know.
Two things. It's my understanding that this series has proved to be much more popular than the Smithsonian ever imagined it would be, which is one reason you're still in business on this. Is that true?
Well, they keep sales figures from me. They do. I don't know. At first I thought that, you know, it could pay for itself. What has actually happened, I don't know. As some of you know, the Smithsonian Collection of Classic Jazz has a platinum record, and that pays for our doing a lot of other records that we couldn't otherwise do. The Smithsonian is both public and privately supported. We are federally funded and we are privately funded. On the private side, of course, we are a nonprofit education
institution. Ripley's private fiefdom.
Well, it is for me in a way, and I won't deny it. You know, I'm having a wonderful time. I've often said that it is as though someone came to me in the middle of my life and said, okay, what do you want to do now? Anything you want, and make it up as you go along. And it's by and large that way, except when they withhold sales figures.
The other point, you're in Washington, you remember the revival of Whoopi at the Kennedy Center a few years ago, and you might like to tell the people here about the flap with the blackface picture in the Kennedy Center program.
Yeah, that's not really my concern. I know about it as you know about it. I know about it as a citizen and also one who saw that show. I wish that Goodspeed and that our record had come out a little earlier or that their production had been a little later, because they concocted an overture, for instance. Well, all they had to do was get some guy to notate that if they wanted something a little more authentic, in my opinion, than what they had. Also, I think that these shows can play straight if you understand what light-hearted theater is. But we are out of touch with that, and have been since Oklahoma in this country. So they think, when they do this kind of thing, they have to ridicule what they're doing and camp it up. I think that's disgraceful. Don't do it in that case. Thank you. If you don't know how to do it, don't do it, right?
Oh, this is not what I was talking about.
I know it's not. I'm sorry. I can't, you know, I don't know. That's not my first-hand experience. All I know about that is a news story, and I'd rather not talk about it.
It's okay. Well, then I can. Then I'll talk about the news story, because I think the people here might be interested.
Well, let me finish one thing I was going to say. I did get a visit from Gus Kahn's son, who wanted to know what on earth we were putting out his father's show with all this extraneous material in it. He would not believe that Cantor had the right to interpolate all those songs. He left my office still unconvinced. I said, talk to Abel Green if you can find him. Yes, now.
I won't, because a lot of people want to go to lunch.
Okay.
Those who want to hear about it, see me 5 minutes from now and I'll tell you.
Would you just mention the future, what's coming up in the future?
Say again?
In the future, what's coming up?
We have At Home Abroad, we have As Thousands Cheer, we have a more complete version, if David will forgive me, of Shuffle Along than New World did, somewhat more complete. We have Runnin' Wild, which I mentioned. We have two more Gershwin shows. We're going to do Girl Crazy, or half a record, plus on the back of that, Gershwin at the Scandals, all the shows, cast performances of songs that he wrote for the Scandals before he did a full show on his own. I don't know. You know, whatever's there, we'll get to if we're still in business. And we are limited, of course, to what's there.
Yeah, I want to hold up lunch just one more second. Yeah. I happen to be very concerned with the standards used in re-recording records.
Yeah.
And when I started hearing things advocated or mentioned as favorable, like taking the oxide off the back of a tape or the bass coating, whatever, I'd hate to see everybody go out and rush out to do that, because there's a lot of studies have been done on this in gap detection. And if you exceed 50 milliseconds in something like that, you're actually going to be more irritating to the listener than if you leave a pop or a click. Now, there are other ways of taking care of pops and clicks that also don't take, that don't change the meter. And I think in a group like this, that they should be aware of these things. So when somebody mentions something that, that is their pet trick, they should be aware there's other ramifications to that.
That has worked best for me so far. Now, I'm sure you know that that there are some reissues where there was de-clicking done by the sliver method, as I call it, where tempos really wrench around badly, and you can hear the splice go by. The worst example of that that has gotten into scholarship so far, for instance, to me, is in Gunther Schiller's excellent pioneering book, Early Jazz, he says some of the Ellington musicians in their early careers did not keep time very well. What they did not keep was de-clicking. That's what lurches their time around. If you hear the original record and say they can't keep time, that's one thing. But if you hear an LP reissue that's been de-clicked badly, you're going to ruin a man's reputation, for that's posterity true. Anyway.
Okay, but that's just one of many variables. There's also things like, to my ears, seem to be detecting some gating noises and that were going in and out. And I'm kind of amused when I see advertisements with the men with white lab coats and an SAE equalizer over to the side, saying the scientific approach, which nobody's ever willing to talk about or discuss. You know, this is our version. You know, that's the phrase here. Yeah. Is that the right version? Is that an authentic historical version? Or is that indeed our version? That's the hang up I've got.
Yeah, thank you.
I've got a similar point there on the Gershwin, for example. You say that, that maybe they could do notation of the overture from your record. Well, if someone were to notate that Gershwin, the Gershwin piano solo,
yeah,
where you made the two changes, that of course would be something which Gershwin never actually played that way. Repeating that phrase, for example, is something which, you know, if you're listening for, it sounds a little alien to the way Gershwin usually played. Is that clearly stated in the liner notes that
was
done?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Also, on some of the early albums, you were missing some of the dating and matrix information from some Victor records. I think it was in the Ziegfeld Follies album. Yeah. That seems to be rather startling.
Yeah,
omission.
I'm sorry. It was my decision not to bother with things like that. I think if you want that information, you know where you can get it. And for our purposes, I decided not to include it. Now, we don't sell to collectors. Yeah. And I don't mean to insult collecting or that kind of scholarly meticulousness, and maybe they will put it in the future. I must confess that to me it doesn't bother me too much.
I think in that particular album, though, you did have the dates on many of the things from Columbia, but I think some of the John Steele recordings you put down date unknown.
Mm-hmm.
And the Victor information is very easily accessible. I was just wondering how come it wasn't.
Well, apparently not as easily to us as to you. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Sessions will resume at 2:00 sharp in this room. Thank you.